Welcome to the CFO Show. I'm your host, Melissa Howitson, CFO of Venice Solutions. In almost every organization, the most important resource that we have is our people. And the way that we used to measure the outputs of our people and how they were creating value in our business has certainly changed or needed to change, especially in the post-pandemic world. What used to matter and those metrics we used to look at simply don't cut it anymore. This begs the question, what are the most important people metrics that matter? Fortunately for today, I have a great guest joining us. I had the pleasure of hearing him speak recently at a conference, and I was taking pages and pages of notes. And so I'm hoping that some of his insights you will find valuable today as well. Joining me today is RJ Milner, founder and CEO of People Analytics Partners. RJ, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. I was fortunate enough to recently see you speak about unlocking value with people metrics, and you had such great insights to share on what metrics we should be measuring and how we can drive productivity. And I thought it would be so relevant for our audience. So maybe before I jump into some of my questions, maybe you could just tell us a little bit more about yourself and your business and what got you into this line of work.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here today. And I appreciate the opportunity to be on the podcast with you and with your listeners. My name is RJ Milner. I'm the founder of People Analytics Partners. And just by way of background, I've spent the past 20 years or so in the field of human resources in one way or another, either as a leader of HR teams, on leadership teams, or deeply in people analytics in consulting or working with corporations. And about a year ago, I founded this company, People Analytics Partners, which is a marketplace that connects companies with experts looking to do fractional work, specifically experts in people analytics or workplace technology. And where this came from, actually, it was very unexpected. I didn't plan for this company to exist or for this to happen, but I was connecting initially people I'd worked with or friends and then people I didn't know in late last year with jobs. The layoffs started happening initially in the tech sector around November, December of 2022. And I was connecting them with opportunities, typically full-time opportunities. And what I heard from people time and time again was they actually weren't looking to go back to full-time work. They preferred the flexibility, the autonomy that gig and fractional work provided. And I honestly didn't anticipate that. But what I realized in talking to them was that these very qualified, high-performing people, what they were looking for, they couldn't find. There was no place for them to go to find those opportunities for these defined project types of work. And as a leader of teams or a functional leader, there's really no place for someone like me to go to find that kind of talent, you know, to find experts that just want to come in on a fractional basis. So that's where this company came from. We're a marketplace that connects those two parties together in a very efficient way.
Excellent. And so you've really invested a lot of time and energy into looking at what are some of those most critical pieces of data, the metrics about our people that can really help to drive forward a business. And when you stop and think about it, you know, greater than 50%, often 60, 70% in some companies of our cost is people. And so it is a really critical part of the investments that businesses are making and what's going to drive value for our companies. And so when you think about that, what do you think about in terms of figuring out what we should be measuring and what we have been measuring historically?
Well, it's interesting. If you think about workforce costs or labor costs, they do account for a majority of operating expense in many cases. It could be 50 to 70% of operating expense, but it's oftentimes the least reported or most inconsistently reported information from companies. I think the question is, you know, what do we need to dig into to actually report that effectively? And for a long time, it's been very basic things, things like headcount or the distribution of employees geographically, things like this, but it doesn't really get to core elements of productivity and cost. I think when we're thinking about the labor force, those are things that we need to dig into. Sure, there are elements like, you know, how many people do we have and how are they distributed, those basic demographics. Those are important. But more than that, we need to understand how's our workforce contributing to the bottom line, whether it's kind of driving profitability, driving the productivity of the organization. How are we reducing cost associated with that workforce, if that's in fact one of our objectives? And there are also very important things that we should be talking about and reporting around the well-being of our workforce. And the more I think about how we unlock value, so how we use the workforce that we have to unleash more productivity in the organization. It's those types of metrics that I'm really keying in on. And when you kind of break those metrics down, I think you can also look at them in terms of leading and lagging indicators. So oftentimes we'll think it's something like headcount or turnover. Those are important. Those tend to be lagging indicators. So it's important to measure those to understand our progress. But there are leading indicators, things that can be drivers of those outcomes that we really need to understand. And understanding the kind of the trends in those or the inflection points in those metrics can be incredibly important.
And what would be some of those leading metrics? What you've talked about, I think, what are some of the lagging ones, but what would be some of the leading ones that you think forward-looking organizations are really starting to double down on understanding?
Yeah, they're not intuitive. You know, so it's interesting. If you think about the lagging ones, these are ones that would naturally come to mind if you're thinking about a people dashboard or a human capital dashboard. So think about voluntary turnover, turnover costs, which on average could be about a third of salary. It could be much larger for professional or executive populations. You can think about profit per full-time employee. And these are typical kind of lagging indicators, things we might want to measure. If you think about the leading indicators, these are elements that drive or have a more probabilistically causal impact on those outcomes. And so those are things you might think of like psychological safety and trust. So psychological safety is the how comfortable people feel, you know, voicing their opinion, taking a risk that leads directly to teams' ability to innovate and perform at a high level to learn. Trust, very tightly linked to performance. Belonging, senses of belonging, which are oftentimes picked up on employee surveys, have a high linkage to performance, lower absenteeism rates. And so these are the kind of things we might look for from a more kind of accounting basis. Also looking at the dollar spent on employee compensation and benefits as a function of profitability. So basically how much juice you're getting for the squeeze, if you forgive the kind of metaphor, but for the amount that I'm spending on the workforce, on labor costs, what is that as a function of profitability? And making sure that number is continually improving and not getting worse.
As these things become more important, you know, that focus on, for instance, productivity and making sure we're driving outcomes and putting the money in the right places, why do you think that the urgency is even higher now on getting the right metrics?
I think because in many cases, the margins are tighter for a lot of organizations. So we need to think about all aspects of our business. And the workforce has been one where honestly, we haven't spent as much time unlocking that value. Also, I think because our people are demanding that, right? So we've been in an era of war for talent since the 1990s, and that's been oscillating up and down. But increasingly, our employees are asking for that. And so the business has a drive for increasing productivity, and productivity has kind of been flatlining since 2011. We're seeing a little bit of an uptick now. But the businesses need more productivity in a way that's sustainable. And you know, we're not just in a way that's not burning the candle from both ends. At the same time, our employees are asking for more. They're asking for a better employee experience. And I think work from home is one of the things that we've got on our docket for later on we can talk about. But our employees are asking to be engaged and to deliver business results, but in a way that might not be the way we've done it in the past. And when you have these two vectors coming together, it kind of forces us as organizations, as businesses, in my particular discipline in human resources, it's asking us to really think more creatively and take a more data-driven approach. And that's where I think these metrics become increasingly important. And not just the metrics, but using those metrics to think about interventions differently. So how do we use this data to take an action that we may have not taken before, to take an intervention, to change the way employees experience their work and their job?
So what would be an example of that where you've seen the data showed you something and then that you use that to help drive the intervention?
I think maybe a couple different ways. Let's use something on the learning and development exam side of the house, which is notoriously difficult to measure in a lot of organizations. And then we can use something on the kind of the productivity side, which is pretty new. So learning development's really tricky to measure. We know it's important. I think we all feel that intuitively, but it's difficult to put a number on it. And it's one of those areas where we can fall into tracking things with activity metrics instead of outcome metrics. So many times when you think about training or development programs, we might try to measure that with something like well, how many people have taken the class or how many hours of training have we used? And we default to these types of this type of reporting, which is really activity-based. It doesn't tell us how good the training was or has that training impacted the business, but it's just telling how many people have gone through it, right? One of the things in another organization that we looked at was, well, what is that training actually trying to accomplish? And with a specific leadership training for senior executives, that company was trying to build cross-functional networks. And we knew that through those cross-functional networks, that was the key to driving more performance. That organization that typically had silos, people would grow up through silos. And at the executive level, we really needed people to see across the entire business and have interpersonal relationships across different lines of business. And so by understanding the objective of the training and not just looking at how many people are going through it, but by understanding the objective, we could say, well, let's measure professional networks of the people going in during the training and then after the training. And we can look at network expansion. And that'll be the way we track this to see if it's successful or not. So it's really getting to what business problem are we trying to solve, understanding that problem, measure that problem, and look at the outcome. And so that helped us refine the training. Moving to the productivity side, one of the things that we've seen kind of get in the way of productivity the most is actually meetings and meeting culture. So it's collaboration. So collaboration can be tremendously beneficial to productivity. We need to collaborate to learn, to grow, develop, to build new things. But there can be collaboration overload in a lot of different ways. And there's a fantastic researcher out of Babson College, Rob Cross, that talks a lot about this. But one of the things that we found when I was at Uber, for instance, was that just after the pandemic, collaboration hours were 90% higher than they were pre-pandemic. I think you saw this at a lot of organizations. Microsoft has done fantastic work on this, documenting this. But as people went from being in office to working from home, this kind of communication that we're on right now, but video conferencing became the primary means of communication, right? And meetings, especially kind of video conferencing meetings, that activity started to be conflated with outcome. And I mean, we found people being in more meetings with more people for more of the workday. I think in our particular case, meeting volume went up by about 30%. The number of people in meetings went up by about 45%. And so you can imagine kind of the flywheel that gets created where you're in more meetings with more people more of the time. But that activity doesn't necessarily lead to productivity. In fact, we found it to be the opposite. And what went down during that time was focus time. And by focus time, I mean having two or more hours of uninterrupted time to be able to focus on a project or task. But that focus time actually went down by about 30%. Well, all the meetings were going up. Naturally, one goes up, the other one has to give. But what we found during that time was that focus time was actually very strongly linked to productivity, both employees' perception of productivity and actual business measures of productivity. So how do you break that cycle? Right. And we were able to, through data analysis, understand there are specific elements of meeting culture that you can use to break that. So a couple of specific examples to be a little more pragmatic for you and your listeners. How about, in our case, about half of meetings were status update for at least of manager meetings were status updates and information sharing, which tend to have rather low effectiveness and low value. That's stuff that can get pushed to asynchronous communication, to pre-reads. They don't have to be 30-minute or certainly not hour-long meetings. So we can move that and take away some meeting time. The other thing we found was that meeting engagement dropped significantly based upon the number of attendees in a meeting and also the length of a meeting. And so it's a great example of how data can be applied to a real business problem. We went through an experiment with looking at 1,600 meetings. We were asking managers to tell us about their experience of the meeting after it happened, but we were also, with their full knowledge and involvement, looking at what's happening with the digital exhaust of all these meetings. So, what's happening with email communication, with Slack communication, with lots of different things during and after a meeting. What we were able to understand was that once a meeting got past, say, 8 or so people in that meeting, meeting engagement started to decrease. So people are on their email, they're on Slack, they're doing other things. Same thing, once a meeting goes past 30 minutes, you see that disengagement increase as well. So there are really actionable steps you can take to get around that. If you're having a decision-making meeting, keep it small. You don't need 90 people in a decision-making meeting. Or likewise, if, you know, if by default, let's keep a meeting at 25 minutes, it doesn't need to be, you know, standard hour long blocks for a meeting. And these things make a huge difference both on the effectiveness of collaboration, but then also on productivity in general.
So some really interesting insights there in terms of what you found as the measures of meetings and the impact on productivity. Two follow-on questions directly related to that. One, how did you go about measuring some of that data about meetings? Where was this all coming from? Is it pre-existing things that companies would already have or other tools that you were using?
Yeah. So we take a, what researchers would call a mixed methods approach. So part of it's quantitative, part of it's qualitative. By quantitative, I mean, you're deep in the numbers, data scientists and that type of thing. The qualitative piece is more through kind of surveys, interviews, focus groups. And I think it really depends on, you know, where a company is, you know, what tools do you have, and that can drive the level of sophistication of the approach. But you can do a lot with a little. So just by surveying employees, you can learn a lot. One of the things that we discovered fairly early was that a great proxy for employee productivity is asking employees how productive they feel. So we can grab all kinds of measures of business productivity. And when we tracked it back to a few simple questions of asking employees how productive they feel, they line up very closely to one another. So a great takeaway for folks, if you're asking employees how productive do they feel, they'll give you a pretty honest response. At least that was our finding. And that lines up with business measures of productivity. Similarly, if you think about it, asking employees, you know, are your meetings effective? Are you spending too much time in meetings? Those types of questions on a simple survey can yield you a lot of information back, or doing focus groups or different types of interviews. You can learn a lot that way without a sophisticated data background. In our case, with that kind of study I was just sharing with you, we did a lot of that type of work, but we were also looking at the data in the background. So we were able to understand how employees are connecting with one another, which is called organizational network analytics. We were able to look at that through passive or ambient data. We were also looking at work activity data, and we always looked at this at an aggregate level, so it's not personally identifiable, and it's really important from a data privacy and ethics perspective. But that work activity data are things like, you know, how many hours are people spending online, how many hours are they spending at work, what kinds of work are they doing, and that helps us get a sense of those kinds of meeting activity or collaboration types of data that we were just talking about.
Excellent. And you talked about networks as well as another one of the ideas of leading indicators. Maybe can we explore that a little bit? What is the data telling you about networks and how they impact the company, and how do you measure them?
There's a great body of work. In fact, if people are interested in learning more about this, Michael Arena has done wonderful work on this, and he's written a book called Adaptive Space, which is a fantastic treatment of this. But what we're understanding about networks is that they're, you know, they're really formative in terms of driving things like innovation, also performance. They also help communicate culture in a really important way when we think about just building and transmitting organizational culture. But oftentimes we don't really understand the networks inside our own organizations, whether it's who's networked with whom, who the influencers are in our own culture, or how to transmit ideas through our organization. And that's it's one of the things that we've been focusing on in a lot of our own work, and the people on Lix Marketplace have been focusing on as well. So how do you measure it? There are several different ways. We mentioned kind of survey-based approaches, qualitative approaches versus more quantitative or database approaches that exist with measuring networks as well. From a qualitative approach or survey-based approach, you can just ask people simple questions like, who do you go to for advice? Who do you go to when you need help? Things like this. And that's a way to start understanding networks. Who's connected to whom? Who are the influencers? Where are the kind of collaboration or choke points inside of an organization? And through questions like that, you can understand where there are nodes in the organization that are connected that might be isolated. And when you compare that to what the business needs, you might understand there are groups that actually need to be in the middle of communication. They're actually fairly isolated. There's also a data-based way of doing that when you can look at, through calendar meetings, email traffic, things like that, how are people communicating? Who's meeting with whom? Who's communicating with whom? And you can build network maps or look at organizational networks that way. Ideally, you kind of combine both of them together because you can understand what a network looks like and the context of that network.
CFO Show is brought to you by Vena, the intelligent platform for complete planning. Vena's award-winning platform makes financial and operational planning more efficient, unlocks performance, and increases financial intelligence across the business, so finance teams and business leaders can plan for anything. Learn more at venasolutions.com.
Really, really interesting stuff. And so when I think about that, as we're looking at the networks for employees, what that'll mean on to productivity, what has some of the data told you? What are some of the measurable outcomes of correlations that you've seen there or impact on business?
Yeah, so we talked a little bit earlier about the role that kind of meetings and collaboration play with productivity, that idea of your meetings going up, especially kind of post-COVID, focus time going down, the impact of focus time on productivity. So that was a big one. We also looked at the role that meetings play with productivity, you know, that there were specific changes to kind of meeting culture or how meetings are done that can give focus time back or give time back and drive a lot of productivity. And in that particular case, for instance, when we're able to increase focus time with for managers' productivity went up 16%. So there are big changes that you can affect with little tweaks to how the organization works and behaves. But we're also seeing other things, like, for instance, when you think about employee onboarding, the faster that an employee can build a network, the higher you can expect their performance to be. And that's intuitive. You would think that, right? So if I'm able to introduce an employee to more people that can help them do their job more effectively earlier, I would expect them to be more effective in their job. But getting that network right and then introducing it quickly, that's where the nuance is. And that's also where a bit of the art and the science combine. And a good example of this is if I bring an employee, a new employee on, do I have a sense of what roles or what people might they need to talk to right off the bat to be effective in their role? And then can I make those introductions quickly? That's one of the kind of best practices that we're seeing. And we've seen it lead to much higher performance earlier on. In fact, if you look at kind of identifying higher potential employees, so the people that you might have a faster promotion trajectory earlier in their careers, one of the traits that we often see among those high potentials is the ability to build networks faster.
That's really good, useful information, both to help understand where you're going, but also intervene where maybe the networks aren't being built quickly enough, or what can you do as a business to help break down those barriers so that people can be effective more quickly.
For your audience, especially on the finance side, one way to think about that too that might be interesting is from an M&A perspective. So some of the work that we've done is around M&A integration. And I think one of the challenges that we often face, especially if you're doing a lot of M&As, is thinking through, how well are the acquisitions integrating into the host company or the acquiring company? And you can kind of think about it anecdotally, but sometimes it's hard to actually see and then understand the right interventions to make. Going back to my earlier point about the data, the use of the data is around identifying the right actions to take. And one of the projects that we've taken on is using network analytics to do that. So if I can understand, let's just imagine there, I've got five acquisitions that happened over the past year or 2 years. Let me look at the employees in the acquired companies and their networks. And are their networks mostly with the legacy company? Or how are they spreading out with the company that acquired them? And you can see, is the company ring-fenced? And it is, was it intended to be ring-fenced? Or are they building networks with the rest of the larger company? How quickly are they building those networks? And you can then get a good proxy of how well that company is integrating. And is that moving according to plan? Or is it not moving according to plan? And see exactly how. The other thing that we found to be useful is trying to identify those high-value or high-potential employees in an acquisition. Even potentially during due diligence, if you can get the right data. But there are certain traits I was mentioning earlier, like, for instance, the ability to the strength of internal networks, the strength of external networks, not necessarily managing up, but actually the strength of peer-to-peer and down hierarchy networks. Those tend to be differentiators of high potential employees. And if you look at the networks of acquired employees, you can start to tease out high potentials that or high value employees that maybe you didn't identify during due diligence, which can be incredibly important for retention packages. In one case, we were able to double the number of high potential employees identified by using that kind of network analysis versus by just having a conversation with the acquired company's HR department.
great example with M&A. And as you're talking about this, I'm thinking about how really both those examples you gave us, one about meetings, the other about networks, you know, both have come under a bit of pressure or different ways of working as we think about what the pandemic did and how it's really changed the way that we all work. You know, flexibility is here to stay. And so what has any of the data been telling you about those methods of work? And are there any metrics we should know there that would help us as in terms of how we think about driving value in our business?
Most of the data that I've seen shows employees have a strong preference for flexibility. And that flexibility manifests itself in some form of remote work or working from home, right? And the question is, well, what do you do with that? And what does it actually look like from a policy perspective? And certainly, I think we're seeing a lot of headlines. You might be seeing these as well of companies saying, okay, we're coming back into the office and kind of a return to office move or wave. I think from what I'm seeing, the reality is a little more nuanced. So despite the headlines of return to office, I don't think we're seeing a return to office move. In fact, I'd probably say the opposite. My bet would be we're going to have more of a work from home or remote play over the next several years. And we can talk more about that in a second. But if we look at, by the way, a great person to follow on this is Nick Bloom, who's a professor at Stanford. And he wrote a great op-ed in the New York Times just yesterday, maybe not yesterday for the folks listening when this podcast goes out. I think when we look at the actual policies at companies that are doing return to office, it's not often a full 5 days a week. When we kind of dig into it, it's oftentimes, well, we want you to come back, but we want you to come back 50% in the office, or it's a specific number of days. Maybe it's 2 days or 3 days or 50% on average, or it's even more nuanced. It's 50% if you live within this many miles or this many hours of an office location. So sometimes the headline isn't what it really looks to be. The other thing is when we look at the actual data, I think we are seeing a pretty steady moved remote work. So the last data I saw was that about 31% of workdays right now are remote. And if you break down the actual numbers, something like I think it's 13% of employees are working from home full time, so they're full remote. Another 28% are hybrid, so they're coming in to the office on a few days a week, which leaves 59% or so in office. And so you're still the big chunk are still in the office full time, which may or may not surprise folks that there are that many employees working full time in the office. I think the question is, how will those numbers change over time? And there was a study from Upwork suggesting that percentage of people working full time remotely or working from home might increase to as high as 22% by 2025. And that's what I have my eye on, is what's the trend and why might it happen? And I think there are a few reasons why the trend might push more towards work from home. I mean, certainly there's an employee preference, at least among some segments, for if not full-time work from home, at least the flexibility to work from home several days a week, whether it's the flexibility that provides, certainly not having the commute and the additional costs that they incur from the commute. And so there's that employee side. And there have been studies that suggest that work from home benefit is equivalent to an 8% raise in the eyes of employees. There's a cost impact for the companies themselves. And so sending employees to work remotely or work from home does have, I think, a positive cost impact for the organization, especially when you think about, I think, on average, occupancy rates tend to be around 60% or in terms of desk utilization. So there's a benefit of not having those numbers of employees in the office, or at least trying to get your utilization, desk utilization higher and having the vacancies lower. There's an ecological impact, an environmental impact as well. I saw a study from the National Academy of Sciences just recently that was estimating that just by going from a full 5 days in the office to fully remote reduces an employee's carbon footprint by 58%. If you think about the commuting, the energy costs from the office, the home energy costs, and then the non-commute travel. So that's a fascinating angle, which is often not considered. But adding all these things up, I just kind of see the trend moving towards more work from home and not more in office.
So if that's the new trend, then that makes me think about how we make sure that we're still helping build employee networks, using meetings productively. Any advice you would have for leaders as they think about that onboarding experience and helping employees boost their networks in that environment? What's working the best?
I think the key word is intentionality. And I mentioned Michael Arena earlier. I highly recommend his work. He's done tremendous research and case studies around this. But it's intentionality around the use of space and also the intentionality around kind of how we interact, both face-to-face and then remotely. So let's kind of break those apart into two pieces. First, intentionality around the office space or the use of space. So I don't think office space is going away by any stretch, but I think we do need to think differently about how we use office space. So for a long time, I don't think it would be incorrect to say a lot of organizations thought about office space as someplace to house employees while they work. That's not the way I see office space being used by leading organizations or thought of by leading organizations now. I think office space the physical space is space to collaborate. And so moving away from you know, desk space and hoteling and cubicles and all of that to more open space, collaborative space. And when we bring people in, what's the most effective way to have them collaborate, right? And then even being more intentional about where they are to collaborate most effectively and kind of meet the people they need to meet, which brings us into that second category of let's be intentional about in-person time versus remote time. And the studies around productivity and work from home are all over the place when it comes to productivity. And in our own work, we found that employees that are working from home versus working primarily in office, the productivity is a wash. They're equally productive. In the academic studies, we've seen everything from down X percent to up X percent, like from down 10 to 20 to basically up 10 to 20. And so it's all over the place. And what it really comes down to is, to your point, how are managers actually working with their teams in either a remote, hybrid, or in-office environment? And getting back to that point about intentionality, there are certain use cases where being face-to-face just works better. If you're trying to kind of discover new thinking, if you are trying to build trust, if you're trying to just to kind of disseminate new ideas, or especially if to influence, face-to-face is a much more effective means of communication. For a lot of other types of work, it really doesn't matter. And in fact, face-to-face can be less effective because of the distractions that happen in an in-office environment. So if we think about what type of work needs to get done, that should determine the mode that I'm in. Am I heads up? You know, am I in office? Am I heads down working from home? And I think we get the question kind of wrong many times when we talk about, is it 2 days a week or 5 days a week? That's not the right question. The right question is, what kind of work do I need to be doing? And then where do I need to be to do that type of work?
I think that you're bang on when you talk about intentionality. And I think as leaders, it puts more pressure on us than ever to make sure we're actually being thoughtful about the meetings, about how we're working and how we're making sure that we're giving employees the right experience, which using data to inform that helps get away from the gut feel of things. So I really like that. You know, a small example, I attended a session last week and I heard that when we're sitting in a meeting, 20% of our brain power is actually consumed with looking at our own picture on the Zoom screen because we can't help it. We're hardwired to look at ourselves. And so, you know, one little productivity tip there was turn off that screen. Don't look at yourself because you didn't used to look at yourself when you were in person in meetings, and you'll get back that 20% to actually focus on the meeting that you're having and be more in it. And so I do think there's, you know, little things like that, even that when we know or we have the data or science behind to help us understand, can really help us with finding all those little ways to boost our productivity. So I guess one last question for you then is, for companies that are thinking about this or maybe are looking at more of the lagging metrics and want to move towards more of the leading metrics, where should companies get started?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the first place I'd recommend going is to your HR business partner. And they've got a great background in terms of human resources. They also understand your business really well, and they're a fantastic partner to both kind of you and your organization. So I think that's the best first place to go. There's certainly other areas to support and partner with along the way. So the experts that are part of my marketplace certainly have, you know, years or decades of experience doing this. People like me also can help, and there are other organizations out there that they can help as well, which I'm kind of happy to talk about, kind of, you know, offline for anyone that's interested. But I think the HR business partner is a great first place of support. If you're interested in learning more about understanding human capital and how to measure it, there's a great document from the International Organization of Standards, ISO 30414, that came out in 2018. And they did a lot of the heavy lifting, try to understand what to measure and how to measure it, and the standardizing definitions around that. So that's something I'd also recommend.
Excellent. Great advice. So just before we leave, every time we have a guest on, we have two rapid fire questions that we like to ask them. So are you ready?
Yeah, let's go for it.
All right. First one. What is the best piece of business or leadership advice that you've ever received?
Best piece of advice I've ever received is it's not about me. And years ago, early in my career, I was at I was doing a lot of speaking to executives, large groups to executives, oftentimes speaking about research that the company had done. Especially in the early days, I would get frustrated when, you know, people wouldn't buy into the research, or they'd have questions, or they'd just disagree or argue with the research. And I'd take it personally. You know, gosh, you know, this is the work that we did, or my team did, or, you know, I didn't deliver it the right way. And my mentor at the time said, hey, RJ, it's not about you. It's not about you. Don't take it personally. Don't be prideful or defensive about it. You know, lean in, you know, get curious, ask, you know, and explore where the challenge is. And it was a great piece of advice, both first, not to be prideful, but secondly, to be curious and, you know, be humble and really kind of explore what's going on in that client's perspective and in their organization. As I grew in my career, became a leader, that took on a new meaning, where it's not about me, it's about the team. You know, it's about the employees on the team. It's about the organization, and to really have that sense of servant leadership. And so that same piece of advice kind of morphed in a lot of ways, and it's something I hold quite dearly.
Now, the next one, what is something that you do in your personal life that helps you be your best self in your work life?
I start every morning with a prayer, and it helps me kind of focus on what I'm grateful for, kind of the ways that I'm imperfect and what I need to do to grow. And I find it really helpful to, it's helpful for my own faith, but also to help me kind of slow down and reflect and practice gratitude and practice growth. So that's something that I find useful for me and my family, and also for my career.
Really appreciate all the insights. You've given us such great tips and tricks and things to think about. So thank you so much, RJ, for joining me on the episode today.
Thanks for having me.
And if you'd like more information about today's show, please see the links in the show notes. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you listen to or watch your podcast, because you don't want to miss an episode. For the CFO Show, I'm Melissa Howitson. Until next time.